Chapter 23. Bennett's room looks cleaner than it did the last time I was here. His desk is neat, with nothing but a cup full of pens and a textbook splayed open. Bennett grabs a tattered red notebook and undoes the rubber band that holds it closed. He flops down on the bed and gestures for me to join him as he opens it to a page near the end. Every available surface is covered with ink. I bend my head closer and take in the dates, times, and mathematical symbols, the complex equations that stretch across both pages. I have to be really precise. How long has he been working on this? All night? All day? I have to find the perfect moment for us to arrive. He points down at the calculations. Like I said, 46 hours isn't enough. That would bring us to 2 o'clock on Saturday, and we were in Wisconsin, almost 3 hours away. He points to a timeline that stretches across the page. We have to be together, and it can't be while we were in the car because we can't be moving. So we would have to go back to the morning, right about the time I picked you up. Okay, let's go. I sit up and open my hands on my lap, but he doesn't take them. Slow down, Speedy, there's more. He turns the page. Here's the thing. As soon as we get within range of our other selves, they'll disappear. So we need to go back to the exact moment we were in the car, in your driveway, but before I put the car in reverse. I think back to the morning. How long did we sit there? It must have been just seconds. Just long enough for us to put our seatbelts on and for me to ask where we were going. Then we left. He points down at the page. I think we need to land at about 7 minutes after 8. Okay. I don't rush him this time. But I can't screw this up. He sits up next to me. I want to test it first. We're going to go back 5 minutes and land in the hallway just outside my bedroom. By the time I open the door, the two of us will be gone, and we'll replace them. He walks over to his desk and returns with a little sandwich bag of saltines. He leaves them on the bed. Those are for you, in case you need them when we get back. Thanks. I stand up and hold my hands out to him. This time he takes them. Just because we're testing this doesn't mean we're going to do it for real, he says. I'm still not sure I can go through with this. Okay. You ready? I nod. Close your eyes, he says. I do, and when I open them, I'm in the hall, staring at his mother's high school graduation photo. I look to my left and find him there, nervously watching for Maggie. You okay? He asks. Yes. My stomach's churning, but before I think too much about it, Bennett grabs my hand with one of his and twists the knob of his bedroom door with the other. He peeks in, then opens the door wide and pulls me inside. It's empty. I grab my stomach and head straight for the bed, but the saltine-filled baggie isn't there. Where are the crackers? Shoot, I forgot. Bennett crosses the room, reaches into his backpack, and returns, holding the bag. Well, at least we know it worked. I don't get it. You do? How? The crackers aren't on the bed because I hadn't put them there yet. Okay, wow. I grab the crackers and start nibbling slowly again, hoping I don't throw up in his bedroom. Bennett recrosses the room and grabs the two red backpacks off the floor, the same ones that just yesterday were decorated with ropes and carabiners and held shoes and sandwiches and plastic bottles of Gatorade. Today, they look much lighter. Stay here, okay? I'll be right back. He leaves the room and returns a few minutes later with heavier-looking packs, another full bag of saltines, 2 Starbucks Frappuccinos, 2 bottled waters. He goes to his desk, takes something from the top drawer, and walks over to the armoire. Removing everything inside, he makes a tall pile of photo albums, scrapbooks, old Westlake yearbooks, and several boxes of loose photographs. When it's empty, he reaches inside and pulls out a wad of bills. How much cash is that? I ask. He's all business. $1,000 each, in case we get separated. Here. The bundle lands in my backpack with a thud. While he puts everything back in the armoire, I think about Brooke and her backpack of cash. Have you and Brooke ever done a do-over? He shakes his head. No, not that Brooke hasn't tried. He talks while he puts the books and photos back where they belong. There was the time she failed her history final and almost didn't graduate, the time my dad caught her smoking, a really bad prom date named Steve. He closes the door and walks back to his desk. Man, now that I think about it, you two have far too much in common. I'm terrified for the day you finally meet. I feel my face brighten at the thought. I'll get to meet her? He shrugs. Sure, once she's home, I'll bring her back here to meet you. We always come back to see Maggie anyway. Really? You come back here to see Maggie? Yeah, all the time. He nudges me with his shoulder. I don't mean to be rude, but any chance I can tell you about it later, after I'm done changing the course of history and all? He gives me a teasing smile. Yeah, of course. Thanks. Then he's back to business. We're going to land at 807, just next to the shrubs on the side of your house. Wait for my signal, then run to the car. Got it. He offers me my backpack, and I throw it over my shoulders while he does the same with his. Oh, and don't let go of my hands, even though it will be hard to move quickly that way. No matter what happens, we need to be sure we stay together. His command reminds me of our rock climbing date when he introduced the belay device and told me it kept me connected to him. He grabs my hands. I look right into his eyes. I've never seen him look scared before. Bennett?
Yeah?
Will I remember everything from Saturday? I don't want to forget the anticipation of our drive, the exhilaration of climbing, or the view from the top. I want to remember the moment when we pulled into the driveway back home, and I felt like I finally knew him.
You'll remember both days.
I interrupt him. But how? I don't remember anything at the bookstore before you left and came back.
That's because you weren't with me. This time, you'll remember both versions, just like I do. Now, close your eyes.
But I can't. I'm getting nervous now, and I'm sure he can feel my hands shaking in his. Are you sure we should do this? I ask.
You're kidding, right?
He humps and looks at me with a puzzled expression.
No, I'm not sure. I'm testing fate. I'm messing around with time.
I bite my lip, picture Emma, and feel my conviction return. Thank you, I say. It's not enough, but it's all I've got. His grip is tighter than usual.
Close your eyes.
I open them to the somewhat familiar sight of our side yard. It's not like I'm over here much, but the chipping yellow paint verifies that we've landed at Bennett's intended location. On the other side of the window above us, Dad has probably just sat down to finish his coffee and read the Sun Times.
Ready?
Bennett asks. I nod.
Go!
We race from the shrubs into the driveway, pulling each other along like we're in some strange 4th of July event, wedged in between the three-legged race and the egg toss. The car is empty. We've done it. I start to let out a relieved laugh until I realize the car is moving backward down the driveway, picking up speed. Bennett pulls me toward his side of the car. We work together to lift the door handle, and it rises, but nothing else happens. He swears under his breath.
It's locked.
I look up at the kitchen window, my heart racing at the thought of Dad seeing this, but thankfully no one's there. Bennett and I run alongside the car until it reaches the end of the driveway, then watch as it rolls across the street, slows when it reaches a snowbank, and comes to rest against a tree. The wheels spin on the ice. This time, when I look up at the window, I see Dad standing there watching us. He disappears from sight and reappears when the front door flies open.
What the hell?
He runs across the lawn and stops when he reaches us. Bennett and I drop our hands.
What the hell?
He repeats. Hi, Dad.
Annie.
He's looking back and forth from me to Bennett, and I have to remind myself that this moment is completely different from the one in his mind. As far as Dad's concerned, the three of us were just standing in our foyer, and he has just shaken Bennett's hand and told me to invite him over for dinner. And now we're standing in the middle of the street.
Dad,
Bennett's coming over for dinner on Tuesday, okay? I say, and then I just start laughing loud and hard, and I can't seem to stop. Dad's looking at me like I've lost it completely. Bennett's trying not to look at me at all. Any chance you have a Slim Jim, Mr. Green? This gets me laughing even harder, and I can tell Bennett's trying to keep a straight face. Dad cups his hands against the glass and looks into the driver's window. How on earth did you lock your keys in a car that's in reverse? I have no idea how Bennett's going to answer this, but at least the mystery is keeping Dad from noticing that we're wearing backpacks and completely different clothes. I start laughing again. I was starting the car, and I thought I felt a flat tire, so we went to check it out, and I guess the car was in reverse, and when the doors shut, I guess they locked automatically. He leans over to Dad. I think I'm a little nervous today, sir. Dad stares at Bennett, and then shoots me a questioning look. Now I'm laughing so hard I have to walk around to the back of the car so I don't make Bennett lose it, too. He's doing so much better than I am. I lean against the back of the SUV, trying to breathe, but when I peek in through the back window, I let out a gasp. When Bennett opened the hatch in the parking lot at Devil's Lake, I saw two red backpacks overstuffed with climbing gear. Now those same packs are on our backs, and when I peer through the window, I see piles of ropes and colorful metal climbing equipment, two harnesses, the new shoes Bennett bought me lying on top of the heap next to the plastic bags of food and four bottles of Gatorade. We went back, but all the gear has stayed right where it was 52 hours ago. Some things may remain the same, but this whole day is clearly about to change. Chapter 24. I'm glad we're not in a hurry, because it takes 45 minutes for the tow truck to get here, 2 minutes to get the car door open, and 20 minutes for Bennett to sign the paperwork and get the guy to stop making fun of him. But once we're in the car driving toward Emma's, I think we both feel a little giddy. He just did something he'd never done before, and I got to be there for it. I know Bennett's still waiting for the dark hands of time to snatch us up and throw us back where we belong, but I can't help being caught up in the moment. If my stomach hurt, I didn't even notice. Hey, how's your head? I ask. Bennett rubs it with his fingertips. Fine, actually. I didn't even think about that. Maybe it is the adrenaline, like you thought. We pull up to Emma's house and find the Saab sitting in the driveway. No broken glass, no broken taillights, no dents, no blood. She's here. She's okay. I bound out of the car and run to the door. When Emma opens it, I throw my arms around her. She's wearing a bathrobe and slippers. Her hair's up high in a ponytail, and she doesn't have a stitch of makeup on, which is perfect, because this way I can see her skin, smooth and unblemished, free of road rash and deep purple bruises. She shrieks when she notices Bennett standing behind me on the porch. Bloody hell! She pulls away from me and tightens her robe. What are you doing here? I don't know how to answer her. I was so caught up in the do-over, I hadn't planned what to do when we got here. Well, I begin. I point back to Bennett, who is looking down and playing with a button on his coat. We have a date today. And I know you and Justin have a date today, so we thought we could, you know, combine our dates. Combine our dates? Yeah, we thought it would be fun. Fun? I look at Bennett. Would you give us a minute alone? He nods and returns to his car, which buys me a few seconds to improvise. I turn back to her. I'm a little nervous, Em. I don't know, I just feel like everything would be better if you were there. You and Justin. You don't need me to... I do. Please. Let's just go together. It'll be fun. I repeat. Fine. I'm supposed to meet Justin at the coffee house at 11. Just meet us there. She starts to close the door. I look back at the Saab in the driveway and know that no matter what happens today, it has to stay parked right where it is. I stick my foot in the door so it can't shut. Let's let Bennett drive. His car's nice and roomy. Nice and roomy? When did my mom get here? I take my foot back out of the door and start down the front steps. We'll pick you up in an hour and a half, I call behind me. I practically skip down the driveway, thinking about how healthy she looks. When I catch Bennett watching me through the windshield, I think he looks a bit proud of himself. Emma walks into the coffee house to meet Justin, while Bennett and I wait in the car, and when she points at us through the window, we both give a little wave. Justin looks confused by our presence, but like Emma, perfectly healthy and unblemished otherwise. No neck brace, no cuts. And as he walks to the car, he looks strong, not at all like someone who was in a T-bone collision. Keep cool, Bennett reminds me. And that's enough to keep me from jumping out and running to hug Justin. So, Bennett says when everyone's buckled in, we don't want to change your plans. What were you going to do today? Justin replies, we were going to check out this record store in the city. Emma adds, I thought we'd go to the Art Institute. Perfect, Bennett says. Music and art it is. I turn toward the back seat to shoot the two of them an enthusiastic grin, and I catch them exchanging awkward glances. By the time I've turned to face the front again, Bennett's pulling up near the elevated train station. Okay if we take the L?
The L? Emma asks.
Yeah, it's better for the environment.
The environment?
Emma asks skeptically as she scrunches up her nose at the train tracks and the grimy-looking staircase that leads to them.
No, really, let's drive. It's so much easier. I know all the great parking places.
This will be more fun, Bennett says, and he gets out of the car and shuts the door behind him before she has a chance to say anything else. The rest of us get out, and I grab his hand and laugh under my breath. I've never seen Emma get Emma'd before. We start the day at Reckless Records, deemed by Justin the most amazing music store of all time. First, we all take off in separate directions. Then we reconnect as the couples we are, and even once as the couples we aren't, Justin and me looking through the ska titles and Bennett and Emma chatting about the bands in the classic rock section.
Hey,
Justin says in a whisper. He looks around to be sure we are out of earshot of the others.
I'm so sorry I didn't tell you.
He gestures across the room about Emma and me. I don't like keeping secrets from you, but it just seemed a little weird. But I've known you my whole life, and I should have told you. I smile, remembering when he spoke almost the exact same words in the hospital cafeteria. That's okay, Justin. Emma told me. It's good. I'm happy for you guys. He bumps me with his shoulder. Cool, thanks. In that case, can you give us a little time alone at some point? Your boy Bennett's making me nervous, and I'm forgetting all my best material. I have some good jokes lined up. Oh, and what do you think of this sweater? I stand on my tiptoes and muss his hair. It's perfect. Justin smiles, and I watch his freckles disappear as the flush takes over. We spend the rest of the afternoon browsing through shops. We eat lunch in a crowded restaurant. We make sure that by 2 p.m., the time of the accident, we're in the safest location Bennett can think of, the third floor of the Art Institute. The hour comes and goes. We take the L back to the Evanston station and pile into Bennett's car again. And because no one's ready to go home yet, we drive to the closest theater and decide to see whatever movie is playing next. It turns out to be While You Were Sleeping, which wouldn't have been my first choice, given that it centers on the story of a man who falls onto the L tracks and spends weeks in a coma. It's 10 o'clock when Bennett pulls into my driveway, 2 hours later than it was the last time we returned from our date. For a moment, I hesitate, picturing Mom and Dad inside, sitting at the kitchen table, waiting for me so they can break the news about Justin.
Will you come in with me? Just to be sure, you know, it's all different.
He nods and we walk into the house. It's quiet. I can tell right away that Mom and Dad aren't at the table, and I let out a sigh of relief. Bennett follows me as I lead him through the dark kitchen and toward the sound coming from the living room. When we turn the corner, we find my parents, dressed in sweats and cuddled up on the couch watching a movie. There's a fire going in the fireplace. "Hi," they say in unison. Mom shoots Dad a knowing smile that seems meant for my benefit. "I see you told her about the car," I say to Dad. I smile and look over at Bennett. He hides his eyes behind his hand. "Are you sure you can make it here for dinner on Tuesday, Bennett?" Mom looks up at him wearing her huge smile, her nurse smile, and Bennett melts like everyone else does when she puts it on. "Because, you know, we'd be happy to drive over and get you if that's easier." She looks at Dad again. "We know how complicated it can all be with the keys, gear shifts, locks." She laughs, and I can't help joining in. Dad buries his face in her shoulder and cracks up. "Not one of my finer moments." Bennett's still hiding behind his hand. He slides it down to reveal his eyes and laughs along with the rest of us.
"It's okay. We like that around here, Bennett," Dad says. "Now we have something we'll never let you live down."
Bennett looks at the three of us and smiles.
"Awesome."
And for the first time since we began the second version of our day date, Bennett looks like he's starting to relax and accept what I knew was true at 8:08 this morning. Our do-over has been a success. Emma and Justin are safe. Nothing bad has happened. And Bennett can do a lot more than he thought he could. Chapter 25.
"I've had the most incredible week," Senora Gota announces after the bell rings and we've all taken our seats.
Bennett and I look at each other and grin. I'm not sure what made Argota's week so incredible, but I'm pretty sure we can top it.
"I've had the unique opportunity to travel through Mexico on 20 different routes. It was exhilarating. All of them were just fantastic."
He paces around the room, and we stare at him with rapt attention.
"But three trips," he continues, "three trips stood out. I'd like to share this with you, and see if I can get your help deciding who should go home today with this."
He reaches into his jacket pocket and pulls out a folded strip of paper.
"A $500 travel voucher."
He snaps it taut a few times and sticks it on the whiteboard with a magnet. I turn around to steal another quick glance at Bennett. At first, I thought working with him on our travel plans would be cheating, but all it took was a smile and a latte to convince me otherwise. On Sunday afternoon, the day after we completed our successful do-over, Bennett showed up for my shift at the bookstore, and we sat in our spot on the floor, pulling books from the shelves and reading descriptions aloud. And 4 hours later, we had mapped two circuitous routes, each different enough to keep Senora Gota from thinking we'd collaborated, and overlapping only once, in the little beach town of La Paz. Now Senora Gota flips the light off and the projector on, and the screen lights up with a colorful map of Mexico. The route is highlighted in yellow marker, and each destination is marked with circled letters that correspond to points in the written itineraries. This isn't my map or Bennett's.
"The first plan comes courtesy of Courtney Breslin."
The highlighted route circles the perimeter of the country, avoiding the interior entirely.
"You can tell from this plan that this unusually long winter has caught up with Senorita Breslin. She's after some serious beach time."
Everyone in the room laughs.
"At first glance, this looks like she's missing out on a lot of the country. But I chose this one because, even though she selects a few high tourist destinations, she also found some wonderful secret beach gems."
He tapes her map to the whiteboard at the front of the room.
"Let's call this one Hora de Playa."
When he clicks the button on his remote again, my map appears. I feel my shoulders tense up.
"Senorita Green has a little of both. Some beaches, some ruins, but it's well-paced. Too often people plan a trip and try to cover too much ground. They're trying so hard to be sure they don't miss anything that they overschedule themselves. In my opinion, that's how you miss out on all the good parts of a country. I like all three of the trips I chose, because they don't try to get everything in. They all save time for surprises, spontaneous decisions. Senorita Green's trip is aggressive, but but she's left room for mystery, for impulsiveness.
He walks to the front of the room.
I call this one La Ventura.
Atrevida. He left out the daring part, so I add under my breath, La Ventura Atrevida.
Our final travel plan is from Señor Camarion.
Alex and I steal a glance at each other at the same moment, and we both look surprised.
Señor Camarion is interested in archaeology and Mayan culture. He avoids the tourist spots altogether. He flies into Cancun, but gets out as quickly as possible.
He is the only person who found one of my favorite spots, the Cahuilnic ruins, which show more of the influence of Mexico's neighbors in Belize.
He turns to Alex.
Go there at dusk, when the howler monkeys come out. It's eerie and fantastical.
He walks to the front of the room again and tapes Alex's map to the whiteboard.
El camino menos viajado.
The road less traveled. He walks over and switches on the light.
I have to tell you, I enjoyed my side of this assignment. You found some places that I've always loved, and others that I'd never even heard of. I was extremely impressed, and now, my friends, I am terribly homesick.
He sighs, smiles again, and says,
So, do you want to know who won?
I already know. Alex has clearly won. I don't have monkeys, howler, or otherwise. Argota paces back and forth across the front of the room, letting the tension build.
These were all great trips, but there was one that was the best-paced, most well-rounded plan. If I were going to see the country for the first time, it would be the trip I would choose.
He walks to the whiteboard and gestures dramatically in front of the three maps.
And the winner is?
He says, pulling my map off the wall and holding it up high.
La Ventura.
The class claps as the bell rings. I walk to Argota's desk to collect my winnings. Bennett walks past me and tells me he'll meet me in the hall. Muchas gracias, Señor Argota, I say, as he gives me the voucher. I can't tell which of us looks prouder.
You deserve it.
He looks at me with an earnest expression. Then he holds his finger up and gestures with his head toward the room, as if he has more to say but can't speak openly until the rest of the students are gone. I start to fidget as I picture Bennett standing outside the door waiting for me.
Señorita, as you probably know, I run the summer exchange program, he says when we're finally alone.
I nod.
Well, this year, we had more families participate than usual, but we didn't get as many applications as we typically do. I know it's rather late notice, but there's still a spot.
When I don't reply, he fills the silence.
If you're interested.
I haven't even considered my summer plans. Come to think of it, since Bennett arrived, I haven't considered much beyond the current day. Argota opens his desk drawer, pulls out a shiny yellow folder, and hands it to me.
It's a really fantastic opportunity. You'd get to spend 10 weeks in Mexico with a wonderful host family. Here, take this and talk it over with your parents.
I take the folder. A few months ago, I would have considered this the opportunity of a lifetime. But now, with the ability to see any location in the world, a single one doesn't sound quite so appealing. Thank you. I'm really honored that you'd consider me. I unzip my overstuffed backpack and push the folder down into it. I'll think about it.
Good. The family knows they might not be getting a student, but we need to give them some time to prepare either way. So just get the paperwork back to me as soon as you can, end of May at the very latest. I'm not expecting any more applications at this point, so if you think you'd like to take the spot, it's yours.
Okay, thanks again. I race toward the door, and when I round the corner, Bennett throws his arm over my shoulder.
You did it!
He smiles and pulls me to him as we start down the hall. I lose my balance in a good way.
So, where are you going with that ticket?
Mexico, of course. It would be a shame to waste a perfect, well-paced trip that allows time for surprises. I mimic Argota's accent and look up at him with a flirty smirk. I happen to like surprises.
Yeah, Bennett says. I've heard that about you.
May. Chapter 26. I put my bookmark in between the pages of Rick Steves' Best of Italy 1995 and turn off the light, thinking about museums and cobblestone streets and gelato. It's been almost a month since Bennett took me to Thailand, told me the first of his secrets, and handed me a postcard. He promised to take me to Italy next, but ever since the do-over with Emma, he's been reluctant to use his little talent, even for tourism. I haven't asked. I've been happy just having him here and pretending that everything about him is normal, but I'm studying my phrase book just in case. I close my eyes and think about him, and just as I'm starting to drift off to sleep, I realize that something doesn't feel right, like a weight is pulling me toward the edge of the bed. "Hey," a voice says into my ear, "it's me." My eyelids shoot open, and the beginnings of a scream escape my mouth. "Shh," the voice says, and a hand covers my mouth to muffle the sound. My heart is racing, and my eyes are wide with terror, and I blink until I can finally make out his form in the dark. "It's me. It's okay." He repeats the words while I try to talk my heart into slowing down. "It's okay, Anna. It's just me."
"What are you doing here?"
I whisper, yell it into his palm so it comes out garbled. "What?" He laughs under his breath and removes his hand from my mouth. "What are you doing here?" I repeat, clearly this time as I sit up straight and punch him in the arm. "You scared the crap out of me." He's still trying not to laugh. "I'm sorry. I would have knocked, but," he says as he taps his watch. "Your mom loves me, but I don't think she'd appreciate a visit at 11:30 on a school night." I feel my heart slow down a little, and I pull the covers tighter around my waist. "Is everything okay?" "Yeah, everything's fine. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to scare you. I was just lying in bed, and suddenly I couldn't wait until tomorrow to see you. So I got up, put on my sweats, pictured your room, and poof, here I am."
"Poof?"
"Poof. You weren't asleep, were you?"
"Nearly."
I rest my head on my pillows again and sigh. I'm not sure how I feel about him, poof, appearing in my bedroom uninvited. He lifts the covers up to my chin. My room is dark, barely lit by the full moon outside, but he must see the look on my face.
"Hey, are you mad?"
I shake my head. "No, not really."
"But a little?"
I crinkle my nose. "Yeah, maybe."
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to just show up. I'll go."
Now I feel bad. He looks so sweet, flustered like this, and just as he's about to stand up, I reach over and grab his arm.
"Don't go," I say. "Really, it's okay. I'll just see you tomorrow,"
he whispers as he plants a soft kiss on my forehead, and that's all it takes for my heart to start racing again. But this time, it has nothing to do with fear. 5 minutes earlier, I was missing him, and now he's here in my room, sitting on my bed and backlit by moonlight.
"Really, I'm not mad."
Without even thinking about it, I grab his arm and pull him down on my bed, and he lands sprawled out next to me, looking a little surprised. I roll over onto his chest and smile down at him. He looks adorable on my pillow.
"Don't go."
He looks at me for a moment, and then his hand finds the back of my neck and he kisses me harder than usual. And even though there's a little bit of the bulky comforter between us, I can feel the heat radiate from his body, feel the intensity of every one of his kisses, regardless of where it lands, on my lips, on my neck, on my chest. And for a good 5 minutes, I'm completely lost in him, kissing him, running my fingers under his shirt so I can feel how the muscles in his back tense up every time he pulls me tighter. But then I find myself again, realize where I am, and move away from him so I can sneak a look at my bedroom door. "It's okay," he's whispering in my ear, but I can feel his breath on my neck. "Don't worry about it." I pull away just a little.
"My parents."
"Don't worry about it," he repeats. And for a few minutes, I follow Bennett's lead and let myself get lost in his kisses.
but I can't seem to ignore the door for long. I steal another glance at it, and he catches me. He stops, breathing hard, and smiles up at me. My hair is everywhere, and he sweeps it to the side so he can see my face. He rests his hand on my cheek.
"It's me, remember?" he says. "If they come in, I'll just disappear and come back 5 minutes earlier."
His smile grows more mischievous. "They'll never know. You'll never even know. Then you can pull me down on the bed like you just did, and we can do this," he grins, "all over again." I look away from the door and lean in close to kiss him again. But suddenly I have this thought. I have no idea where it comes from, why it would be here right now, or why I've never thought to ask it before. But here it is coming at me full force. I pull away and look down at him. "You've never actually done that to me, have you?" I'm smiling, but my face is all crinkled up. "Done something over? And I never even knew?" His smile disappears too quickly. "Bennett!" He doesn't say anything. His head falls back and sinks deep into my pillow. "Once." The word floats out with his heavy exhalation. I feel the lump forming, growing in my stomach as I glare at him and wait for more. He doesn't say anything else. He just lies there, waiting for me to make the next move. "When?" I sit up, tighten the covers against my body, and wait. He faces me. "Remember that first night? The night you came to Maggie's and I was so rude to you?" I nod. "I went to the bookstore to apologize, and we went for coffee." I nod again. "And I walked you home." I just keep nodding because, yes, I remember all that. I want to know about the part I don't remember.
"I kissed you."
"You kissed me?" I would have remembered that. Now it's his turn to nod, and I can only stare at him, because that's impossible. All I wanted that night was for him to kiss me, and instead he spoke some nonsense about whatever happened last time not happening again. I didn't know what he meant at the time, but now I do. He'd kissed me. That's what happened. "It was too much. I was afraid of what it meant for you, and," he grimaces, "I kissed you. And then I went home and realized what I'd done. So I went back and did it over again, the way I'd meant to do it. I walked you home. I said goodbye." While I stood on the sidewalk, shivering and confused, watching him walk away and thinking I'd done something wrong. While I spent the 24 days that followed wondering why I felt something for this person who didn't seem to care about me at all. I can't look at him anymore. So I recline against the headboard, close my eyes, and rub my temples. When I open my eyes again, he's looking at me, sincere and apologetic. I shut my eyes tighter this time. "When did you do it?" I ask. "I want to know the exact moment you went back." He couldn't risk running into himself, and that night there were no moments when we were apart. And it all comes back to me. I'd made a dumb joke about him losing people, and he had gone to the bathroom. I remember how I thought he came out a completely different person. Turns out he had. "The bathroom," I say. He nods. I huff in exasperation. "You weren't ever going to tell me, were you?"
"There was no reason to, but I'm telling you now," he says, and I stare at him fuming.
"Look, I didn't want to hurt your feelings. It was before..." "So you lied to me? To protect my feelings?" He shushes me. "I didn't lie to you. I just didn't tell you. That's not the same."
"It is to me."
"Keep your voice down, Anna. You don't want your parents to come in."
"My parents? Why do you care about my parents? You'll just disappear, and I'll be the one left here to come up with some way to explain why I'm yelling alone in my bedroom."
I lower my voice anyway and continue in a whisper. "Or better yet, why don't you just do it over? That way, you won't have to have this conversation again."
"I would not do that."
The five words come out one at a time, like he means every one.
"Why not? It's perfect.
Just go outside, come back 10 minutes ago, and do it all over again. I'll tackle you and make out with you like I did this time. Not that I'd know there was a this time. I feel the tears start to well up, and I fight with everything I have to keep them locked behind a wall where they can't do any permanent damage. If I cry now, he'll think I'm sad. But I'm not. I'm furious. These are hot, thick tears, filled with the kind of anger that makes some people punch holes in walls. "Anna," he says in a calm voice, "I did it once. I didn't do it again. Not after I decided to tell you everything. Not after I decided to be with you." I nod. "Oh, I see. After you decided." I think back to those weeks, nearly a month, when I walked into Spanish every day, wondering why he'd stopped looking at me after that night. Wondering why I felt such a strong connection with someone who seemed to hate me. "Well, that night you undid, even before you undid it, that was the night I decided I wanted to be with you. But I guess that doesn't count for anything, does it?" The room is silent. I stare at him. He looks down at the bedspread. "I made a mistake," he finally says. "I did it once. I haven't done it again. I would never do it again." I feel my face soften, so I press my lips together to keep from caving in and to keep these damn tears where they belong. "I think I need you to leave." "What?" "Leave. Now. Please." I intentionally use the same words, the same tone of voice that he used to kick me out of his house 2 months ago. "Come on, Anna. You're a hypocrite." I shut my eyes, and for a moment there is no movement except my trembling. No words except the words that have already been said, still crowding the space in the room. I open my eyes, shoot him a stern look, and say, "Go." Poof. I feel the mattress rise back up as he lifts his weight off the bed. I open my eyes, expecting him to be gone, but instead I find him standing there. He looks sad as he closes his eyes, but I don't move or say a word. I just watch the map on my wall come more sharply into focus as his transparent shape disappears from in front of it. Chapter 27. The May mornings are still cold, but I can run in my lighter clothes now, without the gloves and wool socks and the beanie. I hardly recognize the man with the gray ponytail, in shorts and a light t-shirt, and when he gives me a friendly wave, I return it with a dim smile. It's sunny and green and beautiful, but it's not enough to make up for my dark, angry mood. So my feet connect with the pavement harder than they should, and before I even reach the track, I can feel the pain burn my shins from the steady drumbeat of abuse. Later today, I'll pay the price for letting my feet do the screaming I can't seem to do. When I arrive at Spanish, I find Bennett sitting at his desk, exactly where he's supposed to be, and his eyes bore into mine as I walk down the aisle in his direction. I take my seat, wearing a frosty expression. A few minutes later, I feel a tap on my shoulder. Argota's back is turned to the class as he writes a series of conjugations on the board, so I reach back, grab the folded slip of paper, and open it. "We need to talk." I squeeze the note into a little ball and throw it on the floor in Bennett's direction. Argota turns to face the class, and we spend the next 10 minutes talking as a group through each of the conjugations. When he turns around to write out another set of verb infinitives on the board, I feel another tap on my shoulder. Bennett shoves the crumpled paper at me again. "I'm so sorry. It will never happen again." I stick the note in my pocket as I rise from my seat, walk to the front of the room, and lift the bathroom pass off the hook. I sprint through the safety of the donut to the bathroom and splash cold water on my face. Now that I've seen him, I don't know how to be this angry with him. I'm too drawn to him, too completely caught up in everything I've come to know about him to feel this way. I want to understand why he did what he did, and I want to tell him why it hurt me so much.
and I want to believe that he's sorry, so that I don't need to be this angry with him anymore. I stare into the mirror for a long time, watching my own reflection until it blurs and morphs and no longer looks like anyone I know, and I breathe and stare and gather my strength. As I walk back to class, I practice what I want to say. But when class ends, there's no time to stop and tell him what's on my mind. As soon as we're out in the hallway, Bennett leads me upstream, defying the laws of the donut, moving against the current of hungry bodies making their way to the dining hall. He pushes open the double doors that lead to the quad and stops in his tracks. The bright day has pulled nearly everyone outside, and there's not a quiet spot to be seen. Without talking, we both turn back toward the hall, looking for a quiet corner. "Follow me," he says, as if I have a choice, and he pulls me along, weaving through the remaining groups of people until we're at a bank of lockers clear on the other side of the school. He stops at locker number 422, which I realize for the first time belongs to him. He dials the combination and lifts the metal lock with a click. Unlike my locker, decorated with pictures and schedules and stuffed with books and packs of gum, his is empty and completely devoid of personality. Like his room at Maggie's, functional but temporary. He piles our backpacks inside and slams the door. "Can we get out of here?" He grabs my hands and looks around the empty hallway to verify that we're alone. Before I can comprehend what's happening, I feel the not-yet-familiar sensation of having my intestines twisted and wrung. I keep my eyes closed, breathe in, and know a moment later from the smell around me, from the sound of the birds calling to each other, that we aren't in the donut. I open my eyes. It's early morning, but the weather is already warm in the small harbor, and I spin around and take it in. Everything around me is yellow, blue, or red, a sea of primary colors, surrounded on three sides by hills and by the open sea on the fourth. I see a church topped with a bright green cross, a hillside covered with brightly painted houses, divided into sections by twisted staircases built into the steep mountainside. With the exception of a few fishermen on the dock, we're alone in this small, beautiful town, with its residents still sleeping before making their way down for coffee and breakfast. I smile at the ground so he can't see me. He doesn't deserve the satisfaction. As incredible as this moment is, he's not playing fair. "Okay," I say, with venom seeping into my voice. "I give up. I have no idea where we are." "Somewhere quiet." He leads me past the harbor filled with colorful fishing boats toward the boulders jutting out like a pier into the sea. When we reach the shore, he steps up onto the smooth rocks, and I follow him as he hurdles them. He finally sits down in between two giant stones on a shorter one in the middle that creates a narrow bench just wide enough for the two of us to squeeze onto. He looks at me sideways, his face right next to mine, and gives me a hopeful smile. "Still mad?" I can't decide if I want to hug him or shove him off the rock. "Yes, Bennett, I am still mad. What, you're just going to bring me to an island every time you screw up? You didn't even ask my permission." "I was just looking for a quiet place to talk. And it's not an island, it's a fishing village." He looks more miserable than I think he should. "It's Vernazza." I close my eyes and listen to the sound of the surf hitting the rocks instead of the sound of my heart hitting my rib cage. Vernazza, Italy. "I'm so sorry." I've lost count by now of how many times he's said it. He holds my chin and forces me to look at him, but I pull away. "I should have told you." "It's not that you didn't tell me earlier." I look down at the rocks and collect my thoughts again. I can forgive him for not telling me. I can almost understand why he wouldn't have. What I can't get past is that he did it in the first place. He stole my free will.
"What is it, then?"
"You have the power to change people's lives, Bennett. And I don't mean that in a cheesy, romantic way. You can literally alter my life. That night, you changed it without giving me a choice. and you just can't do that.
You didn't give Emma a choice, or Justin a choice, he says. We changed their lives, and if I recall, we didn't get their permission first.
That's totally different.
No, it's not,
he explains. We have no idea what happened from the time they each woke up that day to the time they got hit by a speeding car. Maybe one of them did or said something especially important, and we just wiped it out. We changed it. But we did that because we thought we were doing the right thing. We wanted to protect them from pain. My reasoning was no different. And I had to beg you to even consider that do-over. What happened to you not changing things, huh? What? The rules only apply when they're convenient for you?
I was protecting you.
You can't protect me. Not all the time.
See, that's the thing. I can. I will. Even if I have to lie to you to do it.
I can't look at him. Instead, I look out at the small waves and watch them wash up against the rocks and roll back out again. I don't want you to protect me, Bennett. Not like that. Just because you're special doesn't mean you get to choose what I experience. You don't get to decide what I know and don't know, what I get to feel or don't feel. That isn't the way it works.
Look, Anna, when I changed what happened that night, things were different. I was trying to stay as far away from everyone as possible. I didn't want this.
I glare at him.
I do now, he says, clarifying things.
For a long time after that, we're silent.
I haven't done it since, he finally says. I'd never do it again.
He's looking directly at me, and I can tell he means every word, and I can tell how much he wants this to be over. But I still don't think he understands how hurt I am, that he crossed a line I never thought I needed to define, especially for him. Remember when you asked me to make the choice to be with you or not? I ask. You told me all your secrets, and you let me decide if I wanted this. He looks out toward the water and nods. That meant so much to me, the fact that you had me choose. And that's what makes it so hard to understand how you could have made a choice for me.
I made a mistake.
And, I begin, but I feel the words catch deep in my throat. We lost 3 weeks. We could have been together 3 weeks longer. He lets out a sigh, and his face falls as everything clicks. He took something away from me, but he also took something away from us. When he apologizes again, I finally hear the remorse I've been waiting for. And when he wraps his arms around me and pulls me tightly to him, I feel the anger begin to melt away.
It won't happen again.
I know, I say with a sad nod, and I pull away so he can see my eyes as I say the next words. Look, Bennett, I'm somehow okay with the fact that you can alter the events of my life, bizarre as that is. I give him a little smile, the first genuine one he's seen since I found out what he did. But this is my life. I'm the only one who decides what comes next. I hold out my hand. Deal?
Deal,
he says, and he shakes it. So, are you going to show me around this place or what? Vernazza is just like he described it. We walk away from the harbor toward what looks to be the main part of town, through narrow streets paved with large cobblestones and lined with small shops that haven't yet opened for the day. Bennett walks up to a door with an Italian flag hanging above a striped awning and pulls it open for me, and I walk in. The bells on the door jingle, and for a moment I think I'm walking into my dad's bookstore. That is, until I smell the bread, sugary and warm, filling every crevice of the bakery. The woman behind the counter shuffles over, slides a mountain of twisted rolls onto a platter behind the glass, and looks up at us.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno, Bennett says.
Cappuccini, per favore.
He holds up 2 fingers, and she takes her place behind the oversized espresso machine. A rack of postcards near the window catches my eye, and I walk over to it and give it a spin,
watching the colorful photos of Vernazza and the surrounding towns pass by me. I feel Bennett watching me. I turn around just in time to see him point at a glass jar on the counter. The woman removes two chocolate-dipped biscotti and places them on bright blue plates. Bennett points to me, standing just under the sign that reads, 6 for 1,000 lira in a flowing script I assume to be hers.
Will you add 6 postcards to that too, per favore?
6,000 lira, dear, she says.
Can I borrow these? I hear Bennett ask, but I can't see what he's talking about. He balances the biscotti on top of the coffee cups and pushes the door open with his hip, leaving me inside.
Pick 6 you like. I'll meet you out at a table.
The bells jingle as the door closes behind him. When I arrive at the table, Bennett is leaning back in his chair under one of the bright yellow umbrellas, sipping his coffee. I sit down in the chair next to him, and he motions to the stack of postcards.
What did you get?
I spread them out across the glass-topped table.
Pick one.
Anyone?
Anyone, he says. Pick one and give it to me.
I select the picture of the harbor and the small fishing boats, the first things I saw when we arrived here, and I hand it to Bennett. He pulls 2 pens out from under the rim of one of the little blue plates and passes one to me.
Now, you pick another for yourself. I'll write you a postcard and you can write one to me.
He leans secretively over his card and begins to write. I look down at the little boats on my postcard, and it hits me for the first time in a while. He doesn't stay. Someday soon we may not be together the way we are now, and these postcards will be what we'll turn to when we're missing each other most. The pressure to live up to a higher romantic standard starts to close in, and I compose my thoughts before taking pen to paper. Then I write, Dear Bennett, for as long as I can remember, I've dreamed of seeing what lies outside the only world I've ever known, outside my safe, normal life. And now, here I am, in a small fishing village, as far away from home, as far away from normal as I can possibly be. And as amazing as that is, I know one thing for certain. None of it would matter if you weren't sitting here next to me. You can take me anywhere or nowhere, but wherever you are in this world, that's where I want to be. I stop and hesitate, looking over at Bennett before I write the next 2 words. Maybe the word love is too much, but I feel it pushing against my chest, wanting to make its way onto the paper. So I let myself write the words, Love, Anna. Before I can chicken out, I slide the postcard over to him. I watch as Bennett completes his thought, flips the card over, picture side up, and slides it across the table to me. We each pick our notes up off the table and read them at the same time. Anna, I'm so sorry I didn't tell you, but I promise it will never happen again. From here on, you'll always have a say in your own future. Love, Bennett. At least he used the word love, too. I place the card back on the table so his words are face down in the glass, and I force a smile. Thanks. He looks at me confused, knowing he's missed the mark, but not sure how. I can feel him watching me as I pick up my biscotti and take a bite. What? He asks. Nothing. No, you're disappointed. I shrug and swallow my bite. That's just kind of a lame postcard. I look over at him in a forgiving way. And besides, you don't need to keep apologizing. I thought by now he would have known me better. Once I make up my mind, I don't look back. Is that what you really wanted to say? No, he says. I know exactly what I want to say, but I don't need a postcard to do it. Okay, I'm listening. Okay, here goes. He takes a deep breath like he's preparing himself for something epic. You're amazing, Anna, and I love your passion to travel the world, but I have to admit I don't completely get it. When I look around at this normal life you're so eager to leave, I don't see boring or predictable. I see friends who love you and a family that would make any sacrifice for your happiness. I see the kind of security I've never had and always wanted. I may have given you access to the world I know best, but you and your family have given me a world that doesn't exist on a map. When I'm here, we both have the lives we want. You have your daring adventure, and I have my perfectly acceptable nothing. And more important, we have each other. Now there's your postcard. I expect you to write this all down. I slide him a new one and smile, but I'm only half kidding. He continues as if I never interrupted. I don't think I can go back to a life without you. My face goes blank, and I just stare at him. What are you saying? I'm saying I'm completely in love with you. And I guess I'm wondering, what if I didn't leave after all? The word that was just pressing against my chest minutes ago is now coming from his mouth. And even though I wanted so much to see it on paper, I guess I wasn't prepared to hear it spoken out loud. He loves me. He wants to stay with me. I can't completely process either idea, but I feel lightheaded from all of the hope that's surging through my veins, and I think I'm still staring at him. Is that okay with you? Which one? He smiles. Well, both, I guess. Yeah. I'm just sitting there nodding, not sure how to say it back, but knowing I want to. And instead of telling him how I feel, I take the easier route. How long will you stay? Through graduation? I think again about the words he said in the bookstore the night he first kissed me. I never stay. And now I'm pretty sure he can see the disbelief in my eyes. I thought you couldn't. He shrugs. I didn't think I could, but, well, I've been here this long. What about Brooke? When she finally gets home and I no longer have an excuse to be here, I'll just tell everyone that Maggie needs me and I want to stay here with her. I'll tell them all about you. Come on, do you seriously think they're going to be okay with this? Won't they be furious? He shakes his head no, but says, absolutely. Then he breaks into a huge grin. I feel my face light up as his words run in a loop in my head. I'm completely in love with you. What if I didn't leave after all? He wants to stay with me. That's a lot of Tuesday night dinners, I say. Think you can take it? That's a lot of traveling, he says. Think you can take it? And he leans across the rest of the postcards, pushes my cappuccino out of the way, and takes my face in his hands. Buried deep in his kiss is a new kind of promise for our future. But on the surface, all I can feel tickling and teasing every nerve ending is the intensity of what we have right here in the present. We spend the rest of the day in the Cinque Terre, and then we spend the night there. Chapter 28. I push a pin into the little town of Vernazza and stand back, enjoying the way the newest marker has bridged the gap between Southeast Asia and the state of Illinois. Thanks to Bennett's talent, I've made it home without my parents even realizing that I was gone overnight, and while I don't know for certain what happened back here, I have a pretty good idea. I didn't return to school, or show up at the bookstore for work, or come home for dinner. At some point, my parents may have become exhausted from worrying. Police may have been called. Neighbors could have walked the streets with flashlights. Posters might even have been printed and stapled to telephone poles. But 22 hours later, when Bennett returned me to the spot in front of his locker, the place where we had taken a brief hiatus from our fight to hold hands, close our eyes, and leave the hallway the day before, it turned out that less than a minute had passed, and no one was ever worried because no one ever missed me. Despite knowing how awful the undone day might have been for the people I love, I can't bring myself to regret it. In those 22 hours, Bennett and I climbed the mountain steps to the trail that leads from Vernazza to Monterosso,
the steepest of the trails connecting the five villages. It wound us through olive orchards and vineyards, challenged us with rough climbs and narrow pathways, and in the end, rewarded us with the most incredible views of both villages and of the Mediterranean. We spent the afternoon in Monte Rosso, but when we tired of the tourists and longed for the more peaceful Vernazza, we chartered a small boat to take us back to where we had begun. As it sped through the blue water, jumping and bouncing over the waves, I reclined lazily against Bennett's chest and smiled up at the clouds. Just before we reached the dock, he enfolded me in his arms, leaned forward, and whispered in my ear, "Spend the night with me." Thinking back, I never even questioned my reply, and I certainly didn't think about panicked phone calls and posters and police and neighborhood searches, even though I should have. Instead, I stayed, selfishly wrapped in Bennett's arms, and watched the Tuscan sun rise up over the bay from a tiny pensione tucked into the hillside.